Some years ago, during a corporate retreat held at an exceedingly modernist facility, a colleague looked around and commented, "These buildings make my soul hurt." This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, your host for the After Dinner Scholar. Architecture can do that. We are embodied creatures, and the built environment affects our inner lives. Architecture can make us hurt, dragging us downward, or architecture can draw us upward. And no architecture draws us upward more than Gothic architecture. Gothic cathedrals, noted Pope Benedict XVI, showed a synthesis of faith and art expressed harmoniously through the universal and fascinating language of beauty, which still today awakens wonder. And Jason Baxter, Wyoming Catholic College's Assistant Professor of Fine Arts and Humanities, said in a recent lecture, "I call the Gothic cathedral an architecture of contemplation, and by that I mean it is a building created to promote contemplation. It is a building which is meant to embody and represent the contemplation of the medieval period." Dr. Baxter is my guest on this podcast. Welcome, Dr. Baxter. First off, tell us what characterizes Gothic church architecture as opposed to other kinds of church architecture?
Right, well, the Gothic, say, as opposed to Renaissance or early Christian architecture or Romanesque, is considered a really ambitious adventure in engineering. For example, the builders discovered that using a pointed arch reduced the lateral thrust on the walls that was produced by a circular, rounded, Romanesque style arch. They discovered that they could build ribs called rib vaults, as opposed to solid masonry vaults, and then fill in the spaces between the kind of skeleton of ribs with a lighter stone and plaster. Of course, they also discovered, most famously perhaps, the flying buttresses, which are these heavy, massive walls, which then turn into arches and sort of fly through the air toward the wall of the church in order to support it and reinforce it at a particular point. So when you begin to combine these technologies of the rib vault, the pointed arch, and the flying buttress, it creates a capacity to build higher and lighter. And thus you have larger windows, you have more lacy work. One architectural historian in the 50s, Otto von Simpson, called it the invention of the diaphanous wall. That is, a wall which was increasingly moving towards lace and glass, almost sort of transparent, the sort of ultimate illusion of matter which is being fully penetrated by means of light. So that's what characterizes the Gothic as opposed to the heavy, solid masonry vaults of the Romanesque era, or the sort of smaller, and oftentimes smaller in ambition, but more geometrically sensitive use of architecture in the Renaissance era.
Well, in what ways is a Gothic cathedral, as you've said, an architecture of contemplation, or another thing that, to quote you, a building which is meant to embody and represent the contemplation of the medieval period?
So the interesting thing about Gothic architecture is that it's born in the 1140s and then reaches its sort of high period in the 1240s. So the second half of the 12th century and the beginning of the 13th century. This is also, as probably many of my listeners will know, one of the great ages of intellectual expansion and depth in the West. It's the era in which the university is founded. It's the era in which Plato, not entirely, but in part, his dialogues begin to be taken extremely seriously in the West again. There's lots of commentaries written on the Timaeus. It's the era in which Aristotle is translated. So it's an extremely intellectual era. But in particular, in the latter part of the 12th century, it's really a striking era of contemplation. The leading theologians like Bernard of Clairvaux and all of the Cistercians who follow in his wake, many of whom we don't read anymore, but who are vigorously preaching. There's also a monastery of secular canons outside of Paris called Saint Victor. So these are the Victorines, Hugh of Saint Victor and Richard of Saint Victor. This is an extraordinary era in which it's not just the old monastic contemplation has been occurring for centuries, but it's a new era in which there's a new intellectualism which thinks about the science of contemplation, its stages, its growth. And a lot of these documents, for example, in Richard of St. Victor, as he describes contemplation, you see that the scribes have left pages available so that they can illustrate it. And what they illustrate it with are pictures of architecture, oftentimes Gothic cathedrals, or prototypes thereof. So what you see is that even in a contemporary era, the scribes who are copying out these interesting documents, which are describing the interior space and volume and depth, were thinking about this in terms of architecture. And that's really where my talk began with, was that observation that they themselves felt these sort of schemas of contemplation to be best expressed by architectural metaphors.
So they would have thought themselves creating an architecture of contemplation.
Yeah, I think so. I think they would have thought of the soul as a cathedral. There are many interesting sermons in which the church itself, going after certain passages in the Apocalypse, is described as individuals being building blocks put together in a great creation. So the Christian community, as our rough edges are slowly polished and we fit together in a kind of harmony, create a kind of temple in which the living God dwells. So there's certainly that use of an architectural metaphor. But at least Richard of St. Victor and Dante actually use the metaphor of a kind of cathedral within. And one of the sort of major kind of paradoxes I play with, which I think, is that in looking up at the sort of vault of a ceiling of a cathedral, there's a kind of feeling of falling upward or floating upward into a kind of oceanic space covered in these tall Gothic cathedrals that, say in the case of Beauvais, rise to 150 feet high. That sort of feeling of vertigo or falling upward into the space is, in an interesting way, analogous to entering into the abyss of love within, which, beginning with Augustine and others, is described as entering deeply into myself is where I'll find the creator who sustains my soul. And so there's a kind of, I think, a kind of interesting kind of paradox of falling upward as analogous to a spiritual descent into the depths within.
Mm-hmm. Where we find God.
Where we find God.
Another interesting observation you made is that you said that the Gothic cathedral is frozen music. What relationship do you see between Gothic architecture and music?
Hmm. Well, music is what? Fundamentally sound, which is regulated into orderly pitches and orderly rhythms, as opposed to, say, just the noise that happens when a trash can falls over in the street or broken glass, which is, of course, sound, is that music takes sound and composes it into sort of rhythmic units. At the same time, in a Gothic cathedral, you see that they seemingly began with the center point of the cathedral. If you can imagine a cathedral being a great cross, the crossing of the vertical and horizontal elements, seemingly a lot of the builders began there and worked it out to a perfect sort of geometrical unit. And that square then became the basis, the module, if you will, upon which all the other units are made. So you have arches which span these widths, and basically you have all these sort of repeating bays or repeating architectural spaces, all of which are of the same size. In this way, it reminds me much of a sort of musical stanza, in which a same number of notes unfolds and then starts over in the same number of notes in a particular rhythm. And so in this way, I think the medievals didn't really make a distinction between music that we hear and music that we see. For them, it was fundamentally the imposition of geometrical order upon space or the visual element, or upon time, the acoustic element. And so for the medievals, there's this going back and forth between space and sound, which must have for them made quite an extraordinary experience when you actually chanted in the midst of an architectural space. Because then what you were doing was enlivening time in order to correspond to the very same acoustic patterns which structured the space. And so it's kind of cool that we do find that for a lot of consecrations of different parts of cathedrals, they hire composers to create fresh musical pieces to sing in the very religious service in which the consecration happened. And so we find a couple of moments, say like in certain transepts of Notre Dame in Paris, of the most inventive polyphonic music being created in order to celebrate some of the most inventive Gothic architectural spaces.
Interesting. So they created music to correspond specifically to this cathedral, and
they did. It happened at Notre Dame in Paris. It also happened at the Duomo in Florence, in which very creative, innovative pieces were commissioned to try to create a kind of acoustic equivalent to the architecture. So if architecture is frozen music, then music is liquefied architecture.
Now, when you walk into a Gothic cathedral, the first features you are struck with, or at least seems to me, is how tall it is, as you mentioned. And so your eyes go up, you have that sense of falling up. And then how detailed everything is. There's this sort of this dazzling abundance. You walk in, you don't know where to look first, because there's so much. Was that part of the message of the cathedral as well?
It certainly was, yeah. Just the what I call mind-boggling opulence, which is my translation of the Latin term varietas, right? Mind-boggling opulence, varietas. And as we don't have an enormous number of testimonies to how the medieval viewer felt when he stepped into a cathedral, but the few precious documents we have suggest that he was, first of all, struck by the verticality and the height. He was also struck by the order. We have lots of instances of medievals who went to foreign cathedrals and counted columns and paced off distances, in part because they wanted to create, in rivalry, wanted to create something which outdid a cathedral in Rome or Jerusalem. But we also have these descriptions of what the architectural historian Paul Binsky calls encounters with charisma, almost as if the sort of vibrant personality of the saint sort of bled into the very architecture of the place, as if a building could have a kind of personality to it, or charisma. So we have lots of medieval testaments to how maybe red marble might seem like a blush, or a white marble seems like the glistening of a fingernail. And so it seems that the medieval viewers were keenly sensitive to color, that they felt it with a kind of intensity. Umberto Eco says this as well in his book, Beauty in the Middle Ages, that they were sensitive to it in a way that is difficult for us to imagine, in which we can create beautiful, bright colors at will. But in an age in which one of the major professions is dyeing things and creating colors, and that only comes by great labor, and cloths and these things are extremely valuable, seemingly they felt the very sort of intensity of color to be a kind of precious, valuable experience. So I think they stepped into a cathedral and felt the beautiful colored glass, the intricacies of the patterns of the marble, and felt a kind of joyful hilarity at being overwhelmed in the presence of the abundance of all these things. And in my lecture, I suggest that has a spiritual reading as well. But at least that's the sort of primary aesthetic experience that we seem to know something about for the medieval viewer.
Now, could you suggest a book or two about Gothic architecture that would be an approachable kind of thing for our listeners?
That's a good question. There are lots of books which are written, but many for specialists. I suppose the most accessible one, even if it's a bit old, is still, I think, pretty good. and it's one our students read here, is Otto von Simpson's Gothic Cathedral. It was written, if I'm not mistaken, in the 40s and then translated into English in the 50s by Otto von Simpson, who's a German scholar who had to flee the Nazi regime and ended up at University of Chicago. And he wrote a very beautiful book about, say, the spiritual significance of Gothic architecture, in which he does talk about the experience of light as well as the experience of frozen music. I think that probably be the one I would send our listeners to.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Jim.
While it may not be possible for you to travel to Europe or even to New York, Chicago, or Washington to see a Gothic cathedral, there may be Gothic Revival churches right down the street. And while the experience will not be the same as a visit to Saint-Chapelle or Canterbury or St. Patrick's, they will still give you a taste of what Dr. Baxter calls an architecture of contemplation. Thank you for listening to this edition of the After Dinner Scholar. Plan to join us next week. And as a reminder, why not subscribe so that you don't miss any of these conversations about the great books and the liberal arts. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.